continue our discussion of the Khazari. Just a few more points about, we're up to the second essay, and then we'll go on to the third essay. In truth, it's very, very difficult to see what the demarcation points are. It's not like each one is unique, because each essay blends into the other one, and often there's a lot of reiteration and amplification from one essay to the other. But I think the last thing we were talking about is we were talking about the role of sacrifices. And Rav Yehuda HaLevi gives a very striking example that effectively he talks about the fact that just as in an individual level there's a body and a soul, there is also a body and a soul on a collective level. And the concept is that the tabernacle, the mikdash, is a physical body, and the soul of that physical body is the divine presence. And the korbanos, the sacrifices, are the food to the physical body. Just as a human being eats food and that keeps the soul in the body, so too, in a sense, the korbanos is feeding the physical body, although obviously the building doesn't eat, but it is feeding that physical mechanism which allows there to be a connection between the soul and the body. And therefore, the analogy is that it's not Hashem, it's not the Shechina that needs the food, but rather the food is the mechanism which connects the Neshama to Bnei Yisrael, and that's the Asu Li Mikdash. The Torah says, make for me a temple or a dwelling place, Vishachanti Vishocham, so that I will dwell within you, or within them, referring to the Jewish people. That's a very, very critical pasuk, that the pasuk is telling me it is not so much that the divine presence dwells in the temple, but rather the temple is evidence of a divine presence that dwells within us. Now that's very significant. Many of you may know that in the Jewish calendar, this Sunday is a fast day. It's the 10th day of Teves. It's not necessarily the best known of all the fast days, but the 10th day of Teves is connected to the cycle of events that culminated in the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And maybe it's worthwhile just to spend a few moments, but it is connected to Rav Yehuda HaLevi's point. What happened on the 10th of Teves? Well, what happened on the 10th of Teves was that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, began his siege against Jerusalem. This began the siege, which 3 years later culminated in breaking through the city on the 9th of Tammuz, and which a month later culminated in the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash on the 9th of Av. So Asara B'Tevet is actually the first, chronologically speaking, of the events that culminated in the Korban Beit HaMikdash. Now it's very interesting, if you look at Yirmiyahu and look at Yechezkel, look at the various records of the prophets, we see that many Jews had the attitude that they were invincible in terms of their foreign enemies because they had the temple. If we have the temple, of course we are protected. Meaning they viewed the Beit HaMikdash as kind of a magic talisman that would automatically protect them because God is on their side. You know, the all-powerful God. It's very interesting. Even though they were idolaters, they did all sorts of other roads, but there was a concept, well, the God of Israel is the most powerful God. He will protect us. Our enemies are not able to defeat us because we have the temple and we bring korbanot. Now that is why you may notice, you know, the prophets very often denounce korbanot, right? If you look at Isaiah, you look, they always talk, God is always saying, who needs your korbanot? You know, who needs it? Who wants it? And this raises a fundamental inconsistency, because if you look at the five books of Moses, look at the Torah, korbanot comprise a huge part of the Torah. Right, the whole book of Vayikra is about korbanot, and yet the prophets say God doesn't want korbanot. And how you resolve that contradiction has been the subject of much debate. As you know, those who do not attribute divine authorship to the either the Torah or the prophetic books basically say, well, these are just two different authors, two different trends, that in the Mosaic Code was written by the priests who were pushing korbanot, because after all, that gave them power, that also gave them food, etc., and the prophetic tradition against the korbanot. However, at least under the traditional understanding that all of this is the Word of God, and basically the prophets never departed from the halakha, and the prophets were adherents of the halakha, we have to understand how you reconcile that contradiction between the apparent positive viewing of korbanot and the denigration of Karbanot that appears over and over again in the words of the prophets. But the answer would be very, very simple, particularly the way the Khuzri, although he doesn't specifically ask this question, but the Khuzri essentially answers the question, and that is the following. Karbanot are not an end in themselves. Even according to, Maimonides' view we looked at 2 weeks ago, in which there was only a concession to the idolatrous impulse in people, but even according to Nachmanides, Korbanot are not an end in itself. Rather, Korbanot are the mechanism that brings the divine presence within our hearts. But when one commits a life of immorality, when one commits a life of sin, when one brings their sacrifice, then goes out and cheats the poor, and perverts justice, and commits adultery, and engages in murder and violence, the divine presence is banished from their hearts. The divine presence can no longer be in their hearts because they live a life which drives out the divine presence. At that point, the korbanot are worthless. So the simple meaning is, the prophets are not criticizing korbanot alone, but they are criticizing the notion of an empty ritual of sacrifice when one lives a life that is inconsistent with the Shechina, with the divine presence in one's heart and soul. That when a korban is an expression of a person that is surrendering their life to the will of Hashem. Remember Nachmanides' view that when the animal dies, symbolically, that's what should happen to me. It's as if I'm killing myself. That is a metaphor, not for human sacrifice, but that is a metaphor for surrender, for submission, for nullification of oneself to the divine power. However, that is true only if one lives one's life in submission to that divine power. The concept that I can give my korban and then go out and cheat and steal and hurt people becomes an empty ceremony. So, and obviously if you look at the psukim, it's very, very clear that that is exactly what the prophets were criticizing. They were not criticizing the korbanot per se, they were criticizing the notion of the empty korban that is not accompanied by a transformation of the heart. And that is why the Gemara says, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, he was very boastful in his heart that he destroyed the great dwelling place of the divine. And God answered him, you know, you didn't destroy the temple. You destroyed a building. The temple was destroyed many years before. The temple was destroyed when people banished God from their hearts. When there is no longer a Shachanti B'tocham, when there is no longer a divine presence in the heart and soul of the person, then the temple is just a building. If it's just a building, Nebuchadnezzar could destroy that building as well. Meaning, Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by us. Nebuchadnezzar just destroyed the shell of a building that was left after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And this is the language of the Gemara, where God is recorded as telling Nebuchadnezzar, Kimcha Techina Techon, which means in Aramaic, you have ground up flour that was already ground up. You didn't grind up the flour. It was ground up well before you came on the scene. And at that point, you just finished off, you killed someone who was already dead. So this is very fundamental, that the idea of a fast day generally in Judaism, and Judah Levi will talk about asceticism, we'll get to that shortly, is not simply to fast. Let's say, you know, on the 9th of Av, I would decide, and sometimes people do this, they don't feel well, I tell you what, I got to fast, so I'll just sleep all day. So after Shachrit, or before Shachrit, I'll take a nap, I'll get up, you know, 5 in the afternoon, and my fast will be very easy. One misses the point. The idea of a fast day is not to simply refrain from eating, but it is to give oneself an opportunity to contemplate the circumstances that caused the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and to ask oneself the difficult question, how I, in my own life, can overcome the inadequacies and flaws that caused the Korban Beit HaMikdash, and how I can resolve in my own life, as it were, to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, or at least add a brick to the celestial structure of the Beit HaMikdash by trying to improve myself. So in this sense, this ties in very much with the vision of the Beit HaMikdash as really a symbol of the divine presence that exists within the heart and soul of the Jewish people. And when that divine presence is banished by our own actions, the temple is just a building. There is nothing magical in the temple. The Ramban, Nachmanides, actually has a beautiful insight in which he makes this point even further. It's very interesting. It's a very short thing. It's like one or two words in the introduction to his commentary on Exodus. So one could very easily miss it if you're just reading quickly. Of course, Nachmanides in particular, one should never read quickly. But he draws a very interesting parallel. There's a midrash, maybe many of you may have heard this midrash, that says that when Yitzchak met Rivka, right, the child bride Rivka, that is only 3 years old, according to tradition, and he brings her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and he loved her. Right, the pasuk says, "Vayaviyaha el oala Sarah imo." He brought her into the tent, into the dwelling of Sarah, his mother, who is no longer alive, "Vayahaveha," and he loved her. So there's a Rashi. This is from the Midrash, but Rashi comments that there were three signs of blessing in the tent of Sarah that departed when Sarah died. And the three brachos that Sarah had was, number one, that when she would light a candle in honor of the Shabbat, that candle would last the entire week. The candle lasted from week to week. The candle never went out. Number two, there was a blessing in the bread that she made. It's not clear what the blessing is, but apparently even if you ate a little bit, you were full and satisfied for a very long time. And the third miracle was there was a cloud over her. You know, it's very interesting, you know, in the comic strips, I'm thinking Little Abner or something, used to have the jinx. The cloud was a sign of this perpetual jinx wherever they went. But in Chazal, it's really very much the opposite. The cloud is the cloud of glory that was over the tabernacle. It was over Sarah's tent. That was a sign of the divine presence that hovered over her. Now it says when Sarah died, these three divine blessings left. That without Sarah, Avram could not have these three blessings. But when Rivka came, even as a child, Rivka restored all of those blessings that had existed in the home of Sarah. And that is why Yitzchak loved her. Again, it's very, very telling that Yitzchak's love did not come before he married her, so to speak. But Yitzchak's love came when he realized that this young woman, this little girl, had within her the capacity to emulate the ways and the righteousness of his mother, and brought together all of these blessings. So this is what Rashi says, right? This is why Yitzchak... Of course, it's very interesting. People often bring this as proof, and I'm not going to answer, I'll just throw out it as a question, that the true love in Judaism is not the love that you have before you marry somebody, but after you marry somebody and you develop a relationship and you share experiences and you grow in life, then you have true love, because the love of Yitzchak came after, as it were, he married her, because we're bringing her into the tent of Sarah. Well, you know, that's a very, very beautiful thought, so I just want to point out that with Yaakov and Rachel, it says it the other way. Yaakov and Rachel says, he sees Rachel and he loves her, and then he wants to marry her. The truth of the matter is that in the Chumash, you have the psukim that are written both ways. There is the love before the marriage, and there is the love after the marriage. I'm not going to answer that, that's just a question to think about. That sometimes people bring a proof from one pasuk without considering the other pasuk. But be it as it may, this is what Rashi says. Now I just want to share with you a very striking parallel that the Ramban draws. The Ramban draws a parallel that the three miracles of Sarah's tent parallel three miraculous experiences that occurred in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, and in the Beit HaMikdash. Obviously, her light that burned from one Friday to the other Friday paralleled the candle of the menorah, the seven candle menorah, which had one candle, the Ner Tamid, which never had to be refilled, right? It kept on going, at least during the first temple period. That's the Ner Tamid, which, because of the Ner Tamid, that's why in every synagogue you generally have that eternally burning lamp over the ark, which is reminiscent of the Ner Tamid. The blessing in her dough corresponded to the showbread, because remember, there was a golden table in the Beit HaMikdash, and on that golden table were 12 loaves of bread, and that bread was replaced every Shabbat, and what was on the table would not be eaten until next Shabbat, when it was replaced by the new bread. So the bread that was eaten was on that table for an entire week, and yet it was still warm and it was still fresh. That's a bracha in the bread that parallels the bracha in Sora's bread. And finally, the cloud of glory over Sora's tent is, of course, reminiscent of exactly what the Torah says was in the Mishkan, that there was the cloud of Hashem, the glory of Hashem, that was over the Mishkan. So what is the connection? So the Ramban says the following. The Ramban says this teaches us that the Mishkan, with all of its miracles, the Beit HaMikdash, is nothing more than a symbol of the holiness that we are capable of creating in our homes. Meaning, the real source of holiness is Sarah's tent. Sarah's tent, Sarah is the prototype, is the paradigm of the Jewish home. It is in the Jewish home that God's presence becomes manifest in our hearts and our souls. Now, the Mishkan reminded us in a very physical, tangible way of what we are able to achieve in terms of the Shechanti B'Tochan. And therefore the Ramban's point is, this is actually a cliché. It's a cliché, it's an often repeated cliché, but the truth of the matter is, statements become clichés because they are truths. Okay, you can't dismiss something because it's a cliché, because it becomes a cliché because it is true, and that is that the real source of holiness in the Jewish people is the holiness of the home, the relationship of husband and wife, the relationship of parent and children. That is what creates the holiness. That is God's presence. That is the tabernacle. That is the Mishkan that is within us. And if we have structures, whether they be synagogues, which are called in the book of Yechezkel, Beit Mikdash Ma'at, a miniature Beit Mikdash, those structures are simply to remind us and inspire us to bring the divine presence within ourselves and within our homes. That is why, according to Jewish law, according to Halakha, when you start a Jewish community and you have limited resources, so the first thing you have to build, as you know, is a mikveh. Before you build a synagogue and before you build even a yeshiva, you have to build a mikveh. Mikveh is a ritual bath, and again, if one is an adherent of the halakha, without the mikveh it would be impossible to create the intimate relationship of husband and wife and life. And therefore God says, before you build me a shul, build yourself a Jewish home. Build yourself a home, because that is where I will truly be. I will be with you in that home. And this is what the Ramban points out, that all the miracles of the temple are simply imitations, as it were, of the holiness that exists in the tent of Sarah. Now granted, most of us are not going to be able to totally replicate the tent of Sarah, but that is at least the model to which we aspire. And again, this is Rav Yehuda Levi's making the point. Again, it's not his point, it's a point that the Chachamim and the Gemara make many times, and even the Chumash itself makes, the Shachanti B'Tocham, that this is simply the body which enables the divine presence to be within us. In this sense, if I could digress for a moment, because I do want to speak a little bit about this. You know, it's very interesting that we have two temples that were destroyed, right? We have the temple destroyed by the Babylonians in the standard date that's given is around 586 BCE, although Jewish chronology seems to move it around over 100 years later. It's one of the great mysteries in Jewish chronology. The Chachamim's chronology of how long the first and second temple stood would actually dictate a gap of around 130 years. Like their whole books, I have a book which tries to summarize around 60 answers to that question. But be it as it may, 586 BCE is the standard answer. And then we have the second temple that was destroyed by the Romans in the year, again, either 68, 69, or 70. There are a number of different years that are given for that. Now, what's interesting is, Asara Beteveh, as far as I know, does not really have any connection to the second temple period, per se. Unlike the ninth of Av, which is the destruction, unlike the ninth of Av, which is the destruction date of both the first and the second temple, Asarah B'Teveh is concerned exclusively with the Churban of Nebuchadnezzar, of the Babylonian king, who began his siege against Jerusalem that lasted for 3 years. So it would seem that when it comes to Asarah B'Teveh, our contemplation would be focused on the loss of the first temple, more so, perhaps, than the Second Temple, because there is really no historical event. Now, by the way, Asarah B'Teveh, this is actually not very well known, I don't know why, Aser B'Tevet has been given a contemporary significance by the Israeli chief rabbinate, although very few people follow this. That is, they have designated this as the day to be observed as a yahrzeit for all the victims of the Holocaust whose day of death is unknown. It's very interesting. There are many victims of the Holocaust who, unfortunately, we don't know when they died. There's always a question, I mean, my own grandparents, there's always a question of when Kaddish should be recited for them once a year. And the Israeli chief rabbinate has tried to say, well, let's fold it in to an existing fast day in which we think not only about the temple, but about the Holocaust and the like. And although Tisha B'Av perhaps might have been a more logical candidate, but Tisha B'Av is filled with its own keynote and the like, so they actually designated Asara B'Tevet. But as far as I know, I've never met anyone that particularly follows that particular practice. I know that my father observes the Yahrzeit on Yom Kippur, and many people do. Yom Kippur is considered to be a day of atonement.
They're
halakhic using Shabbat, because again, that's the issue. That's really the issue of Holocaust Memorial Day and memorialization of the Warsaw Ghetto. There are halakhic issues in making mourning days of mourning and sadness during the month of Nisan. So they specifically wanted to avoid that. That's one of the reasons why, among some people, the 27th of Nisan is a problematical observance. Okay, but what I want to share with you is this, though. So let's assume, because of the historical reasons, that Asara B'Tevet is connected primarily with the destruction of the first temple, more than the second temple. Now, all of us know, this is a very well-known Gemara, that the first temple was destroyed because of the three worst Averos that exist. Avodah Zarah, idolatry, which was rampant during those times. Giloy Arayot, sexual offenses, right, promiscuity and adultery, and Shvichut Damim, and the spilling of blood. So, the second temple, we are told, was destroyed, although the Jews were observant. It was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, because of hatred, polarization, dissension that existed among the Jewish people. Well, I can look at Sinat Chinam and say, well, we certainly have that problem. On the other hand, if we look at Asara B'Tevet as focusing not so much on the reasons for the destruction of the second temple, but on the reasons for the destruction of the first temple, one might ask themselves, well, you know, okay, I'm not perfect, but I don't go around murdering people, I don't commit adultery, and I don't worship idols. So the question is, how are we supposed to relate, in terms of our own tshuvah, to the Averot of Avodah Zarah, Gilei Reich, Shvichat Damim, which seem to be, you know, thank God, largely beyond us. So, first of all, this actually ties into the Kuzari, because the interesting point is the following. Even if I can look at myself, you can look at yourself and say, well, I don't murder, I don't worship idols, and I don't commit adultery. Well, first of all, even that we have to qualify. Remember that Chazal tell us that murder can come in many, many forms. Chazal say, for example, one who humiliates another human being publicly is as if they murdered them. Chazal say, one who engages in anger is as if they are an idol worshiper. So the truth of the matter is, if things like embarrassing people equals murder, if things like anger equals idolatry, however you understand the connection, then obviously, on some level, Avodah Zarah, Yilei Arayah, Shvichat Damim is something that can still exist within our hearts. By the way, the Baal HaTanya offers a very intriguing explanation why anger is equal to idolatry. Why is anger connected to idolatry? He says, why is a person angry? A person is angry because someone has done something to them that they didn't want to happen. They've been victimized in some way. Now, if one truly has faith in God, that everything that happens in my life is because it was the will of God that that happened to me at that moment, then how can you be angry unless at the moment of your anger you don't believe it is God's will that this happened to you? And to deny that it is God's will that it happened to you is a form of idolatry, because you're denying the omnipotence of God being involved in every experience that occurs in your life. The Balatanya asserts that no one can harm you and no one can help you unless it is the will of God that that help or that harm occur. Therefore, he argues, he interprets the rabbinic statement, that anger, by definition, is a denial that God is calling those shots, and therefore he treats it as a form of idolatry. Now, I do want to say that this is a problematical notion in many, many ways, and it would appear that other commentaries differ with this approach. For example, some commentaries take the position, again, of course, how you do the Holocaust as well, that since God created a world of free will and human autonomy, the evil that one human being perpetuates on another human being is not a direct function of divine will, but it is the fallout of the human autonomy of choice. In other words, the person who kills me, so the Or HaChaim writes, did not necessarily cause my death because it was God's will that I die, but rather God may let it happen, because, of course, it is God's will in a higher sense. In a more abstract sense, it is God's will that human beings have the capacity of choice. That is also God's will. But if it's God's will that human beings have the capacity of choice, then the argument would be that creates a certain reign, free reign, for human actions to occur, which in their specifics are not necessarily the decree of God. This is what the Or HaChaim says. But the Balatanya seems to take an opposite approach. The Balatanya takes the approach that which actually is more consistent with Kabbalistic approach generally, that nothing happens unless it is decreed by God. Again, this, I don't want to elaborate on this too much now, but obviously it's a very, very intriguing and very, very important issue as to the nature of evil in the world. In other words, is evil something that God wills should occur for whatever reason, or is evil to a large extent a function of the human capacity of choice? Meaning, does Auschwitz raise the question, where was God? Or does Auschwitz raise the question, where was man? And basically it would really depend on these two different approaches. But going back to my main point, I just want to say that certainly, therefore, if Shvichut Damim includes humiliating somebody, and if Avodah Zarah includes anger, then, you know, we do have that as well. Yeah?
The subcategory of those three things, I see that one can be Shiva, but what if someone has really either killed, committed adultery, or committed idol worship? How do you
Well, idol worship itself, although it's a very, very severe sin, obviously, idol worship is relatively easy to do tshuva, because that's a sin to God. So one does tshuva the same way one does any other, just like desecrating Shabbat or whatever it is. Gilui Arayot is a bit more difficult, but nevertheless, there is tshuva for that. The issue of murder, this is the old question. Some of you may have seen a book that Simon Wiesenthal compiled called The Sunflower.
Mm-hmm.
Very fascinating. It came out with a new edition with new people. Now, this involved an actual story that happened to him, in which some SS person who was dying in a hospital wanted to see a Jew. Any Jew is good. Get me a Jew. And on his deathbed, he wanted the Jew to forgive him for the atrocities that he committed. And he was blind. He was already wearing bandages over his eyes. He just wanted a Jew. And Wiesenthal was kind of confused. He didn't know what to do, and finally just walked out. He didn't say a word. And the person died, and Wiesenthal couldn't criticize him and couldn't offer him forgiveness. So afterwards, he submitted this question to a whole bunch of people, Christians, Jews, Muslims, all sorts of intellectuals and theologians, asking them, what would you do in my case? Would you forgive the SS person that turns to you and begs for forgiveness? And it's interesting that most of the Christian respondents said sure, and most of the Jewish respondents said no, as you would expect. But one of the issues that is raised is the following. If someone sins against me, and asks for my forgiveness, I am supposed to try to forgive them if they're sincere. I mean, sincerity was another issue here, because the guy is dying, you know, what if he wouldn't be dying? What if, you know, what if Germany would be winning the war? What would he do? But the only question is, can I forgive that which is done to others? What gives me the right? Who made me the representative of the Jewish people and of the millions of people who died? Right? That's part of the issue. And the truth of the matter is, in a sense, therefore, there is really no earthly tshuva that one can do for murder. There is a protocol. One should take a minyan of people and go to a grave and ask for forgiveness. And then, God has his calculation. I think there is ultimate forgiveness when there is sincere repentance of the heart. On some level, on a cosmic level, there's an ultimate forgiveness. But there is nothing on earth that can truly be an atonement, simply because you cannot undo the damage that was created. Yeah.
I'm thinking to another point. Maybe I'm using the word wrong, but sometimes there's a positive anger against social injustice.
Yes, that's a very interesting point. You know, if you look at duties of the heart, that we had studied in the beginning, maybe we'll get back to at the end. He has a whole essay, and Maimonides took up this idea much later, that negative attributes are never truly negative. Negative attributes can be used in positive ways, and the particular example is anger. Anger is a negative and destructive attribute. On the other hand, when there's evil in the world, one needs to have a sense of indignation and being able to fight it. But even so, there's a difference. There is the anger that involves a loss of control, and there's the anger which is directed and focused to accomplish positive ideas. That the way this was described is, it was described by some of the great tzaddikim, that their anger was something they kept in a box in their pocket. They could pull it out when they needed it, and then they put it back in the box when they didn't need it. That's very, very different. That is a controlled and focused approach to deal with evil in the world and to try to eradicate it. It is not the loss of control. And the, you know, anger is literally, if you just imagine the physical, the physiological process of anger, it is a demon within. One is really possessed. Now, it may only be for 2 seconds, but, you know, there is a certain moment of that adrenaline pumping into the body in which a person is willing to say anything, is willing to do anything. There may be a second, maybe it's only a fraction of a second, in which a person might be willing to even kill. Right? That anger is not good. That anger one should obviously cease to try to control and try to eradicate. But the anger of being affected at bad things that happen in the world and trying to do something about them, that's a very, very focused anger. They say the Alter of Kelim, who was one of the great tzaddikim at the beginning of the century, he had an anger jacket. It was a red jacket he put on. And he said that whenever he felt angry, he would not allow himself to have that feeling till he went to his closet and put on the jacket. Obviously, by the time you get the jacket, you know, you're kind of over it already. But those are the tricks that you have. Yeah.
Rabbi, you talked about the symbols for idolatry and
for murder.
What about the adultery
and the vine? Well, once again, as you know, there are two types of sins in the Torah. There's the sin between man and God, and there's the sin between man and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, man and human being. Now, adultery is, of course, a combination of both. It's a violation of God's law, but it's also a fundamental betrayal, both on the part of the spouse committing adultery and on the part of the other person. It's a betrayal of the love and faith that is supposed to exist in a marriage. Now, the halacha is very, very clear here, that in order for there to be tshuva, when you commit a sin, bein adam l'chaveiro, one must seek the appeasement and reconciliation of the other person who was harmed. But I'll tell you where you get into a problem. You get into the following problem. Let's take a very practical situation. A spouse, let's give an example, a woman commits adultery, let us say, and now she wants to do tshuva. Her husband, or the wife, whichever one, is unaware. In order to do tshuva, you're supposed to go to the person and ask their forgiveness. The question is it better not to say it? The question is, do you ask forgiveness if in the process of asking forgiveness, you can make the situation much worse. That's a very agonizing dilemma, because first of all, it may not always be the case that it may make the matter much worse. Perhaps by opening the doors, one could come to a new level of reconciliation and understanding. When there are secrets between people, it's not so much the case, the other person is totally oblivious. There's often a sense of some wall and some barrier. Very, very hard question. I mean, one would have to evaluate each circumstance. It is clear, however, that there might be times in which the imperatives of reconciliation might indicate a non-disclosure. And that's very tricky. And I'll give you a simpler example, a less tragic example, but Lashem Hara is a good example. Let's assume that I said a nasty piece of gossip about somebody. I said, this person is the stingiest person who ever lived. And now I feel real bad that I disparaged somebody's reputation. But they don't know that I said it about them. So I'm supposed to ask them for forgiveness. So what am I supposed to do? I've gotten these calls before. Somebody comes up and says, I want to apologize to you. So I say, for what? He says, you don't want to know. I said something about you, you know. Now, you know, the question is, how does that make me feel? Now, what's the person say? Right? So this was actually a machloket between two great, 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 pious, righteous people, the Chafetz Chaim and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, where the Chafetz Chaim took the position that in asking forgiveness for Lashon Hara, you have to tell the person what you said and make amends and, as it were, ask for his forgiveness. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, if by such a disclosure you're going to make that person feel worse than if he wouldn't have known about it, then at that point God exempts you from the requirement of seeking affirmative forgiveness. So adultery poses the same issue in a much, I think, more intense form, but it's that same type of issue, meaning sometimes the mechanics of tshuva and reconciliation have to be dispensed with if it's going to cause much greater pain. And for a person to say, yes, but I need to get it off my chest. Well, the answer is, sometimes you have to bear that pain, as opposed to simply, foisting it onto somebody else. Yes?
I thought there were three things that you weren't about to get over them. One of them, and they're the ones you're talking about.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Sure, that's correct.
Right, okay.
Yep.
So, if that's so, then there's a double sin. In other words, not only have you done the sin of adultery,
yes,
but you've also chosen that over, assuming that your life was threatened.
Well, I wouldn't treat that as a double sin. I would just treat that as an indication of how far the sin goes. The sin is so severe that you must be willing to give your life. I wouldn't say therefore, if I committed adultery, I have two sins. One is I committed the adultery, and one is I didn't give my life. It's really kind of just an intensification of what that is. But first of all, when I say adultery, idolatry. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I mean, from the other one.
Yeah, okay. Either way, that's right. I mean,
murder, right?
Okay, and murder, that's right. You
those
don't,
are three that you weren't supposed
to. Those are three. Those are the three for which the first temple was destroyed.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one level in which Avodah Zarah, Gilurai, Shlichut Damim still can apply to us in at least attenuated levels. I also want to share with you a thought, a beautiful thought, and a very scary thought in a way, that I once read from Rabbi Aaron Cutler, who was also a great rabbi who came to the United States during World War II. He was instrumental in saving many, many potential victims of the Holocaust. He started the world-famous Yeshiva in Lakewood, one of the great, great geniuses and tzaddikim of our time. And he used to spend the latter part of his career was spent in fundraising a lot, you know, because as anyone that has an institution of Jewish learning knows, you gotta kind of knock on the doors a lot. And in a way, it was kind of on one level, it was a waste of him. He was one of the most brilliant Talmudic scholar in the world. He was a wonderful teacher. And yet, he was spending weeks and months away from his students, away from his studying, he was going to all sorts of places. And people were not necessarily sensitive to the importance of Jewish learning in those days. So he would get a $5 check and a $10 check, and he was the most famous rabbi in the world, for those who knew who famous rabbis were. I mean, many people didn't even know who he was, and they were treating him like kind of an itinerant beggar who was going from place to place. So But somebody once asked him, you know, why should it be that a man of your caliber, you know, should be forced to be knocking on doors and getting $5 donations? Again, Rabbi Kutler would never characterize himself as a man of his caliber, but the speaker, you know, asked him that question. And Rabbi Kutler said the following thing. Well, you know, walking from door to door and going from place to place is galus, right? Exile. The Torah says, when you kill somebody inadvertently, when you murder by accident, the punishment is you are exiled to the city of refuge. He says, every teacher potentially makes decisions that could destroy someone's spirit. Every teacher, you know, you exclude somebody, you embarrass somebody, you put somebody down. He says, maybe, he said on himself, maybe I killed somebody. I crushed somebody's spirit. And therefore, it was inadvertent, of course, but therefore I go into galut. Therefore I also go into exile. Which is an amazing idea, because if you envision the notion of a parent, of a teacher, and anyone, you can see indeed that a life can be crushed by the way we relate to that person. And therefore, the concept that we're not murderers, perhaps we have to redefine what Shvichut Damim means. So again, all of this is going back to the Atzara, the Tevet idea. But there's another idea, and this is the Kuzari brings in as well. And that is, I don't know if you noticed this, but it's worthwhile to give it a second look, if you didn't, because it is one of the most controversial chapters in the Bible. And the Kuzari has a brief explanation of it. And that is his exposition of Isaiah chapter 53. Actually, it begins in 52 and it goes into 53. This is the chapter that is known in Christian theology as the chapter of the suffering servants. And this is one of the primary sources that Christianity looks to show that Jesus and his mission were foretold in the Jewish Bible. And it describes, it begins in Hebrew, Hinei Yaskil Avdi, behold, my servant shall become great. And it talks about a servant, which, well, again, we'll see, the question is who the servant is. The servant who will be sick and marred and tortured and afflicted and will eventually become the Messiah, or will eventually become great. And the verse says that the Umot HaOlam will look at this servant of God and say, he has borne our sins, he has carried away our pain, and in his injuries we will be healed. U'b'chaburato nirpa lanu. So obviously, Christianity identifies the servant of God, doesn't say Mashiach, but the servant of God as the Messiah, and the concept of vicarious atonement, that through the sufferings of Jesus, there is atonement that is brought for the sins of the world, is traced directly into that verse of Isaiah. It's very important to note, Rav Yehuda Halevi does not make a big polemical point here, but it's important to note that Rav Yehuda Halevi, almost as an aside, offers a diametrically different interpretation of who the suffering servant is. And he says, the suffering servant of Isaiah 52 is not at all the Mashiach, even the real Mashiach. Rather, the suffering servant refers to the Jewish people as a whole. The Jewish people are the suffering servant of God, who will emerge from their history with persecution and with torture and with mockery. And it even says in the Pasuk, actually it's really hauntingly foreshadowing the history of anti-Semitism in that biblical chapter, because it even says that the Umot HaOlam are going to say, we don't even want to look at a Jew. And the Ibn Ezra writes that there were cultures in which if someone saw a Jew, they would cover up their face. And the whole concept of a Jew was associated with leprosy. The whole history, at various points, Jews were considered to be lepers, that you couldn't be near them, or whatever it is. And so, but the question still becomes, all right, good. So now we move the focus of that chapter away from the individual Mashiach to a description of the afflictions and faithfulness of the Jewish people in following God, no matter how difficult it is. But still, you still have that vicarious atonement problem. What does the Pasuk mean that the nations of the world are going to say, He, let's say that he is the Jewish people. The Jewish people have borne our sins. In their torture, we're going to have atonement. I mean, you still have the theological problem of what are we saying? Is the prophet suggesting the very radical idea that somehow the Jewish people's suffering is an atonement for the world's evil? Some have suggested that. Some have suggested that it's the Jesus idea writ large, that the Jewish people indeed suffer because of the world. Again, it's a very, very complicated idea. There are whole books of this. If one is interested, you know, there are books which are entitled The Jewish Interpretations of the Suffering Servant Chapter. I mean, you can get a two-volume work summarizing the various ideas and how this was such an influential chapter in the various polemics against Christianity that were very common in the Middle Ages. But one of the ideas here is that there is an idea that is emphasized in Kabbalah to the effect that the holiness that the Jewish people bring into the world indirectly elevates the world. And when our holiness is not strong enough, then the world itself gets corrupted in very, very difficult ways. It's hard to understand this rationally. The concept that we contribute to raising the holiness of the world. And therefore, in a very real sense, it is a double standard, but in a very real sense, the evil that exists in the world, it's not that it's our fault, but could have been counteracted by holiness. And therefore, there's a certain accountability in a spiritual sense for what goes on in the world. In that sense, we live in a world, and there's no question, that we live in a world full of murder, full of violence, full of sexual immorality, full of idolatry in the sense of false idols that people put up. We may not be personally guilty, but there is a concept in which if we would perhaps increase the holiness of our lives, there would be a ripple effect. You know, every week or so in the United States now, we have the tragedy of the high school massacres. Some kid brings a gun in, and I'm sure all of you have seen in Time Magazine the Columbine, the two kids actually made a videotape about what they were planning to do. And, you know, I mean, it sure did. I'm not going to say the videotape is more tragic than the massacre, but it certainly adds a certain dimension of tragedy as to how one can be so consumed with anger and with evil and with resentment. And they even said, the kids actually said it was a fairly profound statement, I thought. They said, we can't let this anger go away. We have to let this anger intensify because we're going to be the only way we're going to have the ability to carry this out. Because if you're not consumed with rage, you can't take a machine gun and kill people. So they were building on it and being sure it didn't go away. So the truth of the matter is, we do live in a world of Avodah Zarah. Gili Arayat Shlichutanu. Even if we ourselves are not directly involved, do we live in a world in which we become too tolerant of it? Too accepting of it? Do we live in a world in which we have not radiated enough Kedusha in the world to somehow transform the world? So as Isaiah 52 indicates, there is or 53 at that point, there is indeed a certain spiritual accountability for what have we done in a small way to make the world more invulnerable or impervious to the destruction and the filth that we find around us. So in that sense, if Asara B'Teve is when we think about Avodah Zarah D'Vayit Shlichut Amim, then it is something that we can think about even on a personal level as well. Sorry?
I find this concept of Jesus, I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said something like, God doesn't choose anyone to have a religion to do that. And I was so offended because I took it as, I knew that someone had kind of wrote that, they just didn't want to you know, say rather than an insecure thing, but it's
right.
so clear. And I wonder, really, how we deal with that concept in this day and age when it is so offensive to so many people. I mean, offensive to the point that I know Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan really felt that we have to do away with it as a concept, but you know, the chosenness, because it is so misunderstood and it's been accused of so much.
Well, yeah, listen. Things are misunderstood, things are distorted, and things are sometimes sources for hostility. That doesn't mean that they're not true. But the other thing is, again, one has to emphasize over and over again that whatever chosenness means, it does not refer to elitism, it does not refer to disparagement of others. It refers to responsibilities, it refers to having to live by higher and more elevated standards. And it's living a life in a way that should be an inspiration to others and a joy to others by making the name of God beloved among other people. So there's no question, I've said this many, many times already, that any Jewish education that stresses in any way the denigration of another human being, whether it be a racist thing or whatever it would be, is really destructive to the ends of what Torah is supposed to be. If you read the biographies, let's say, of great righteous people, you always see the tremendous care and concern and respect that they showed every human being, whether it be the garbage man or the receptionist or the non-Jewish janitor in the school, etc. Now, it is true that sometimes the notion of chosenness has been taken in the Jewish educational setting to suggest that, you know, one is better than somebody else. That's not really the appropriate attitude. In fact, one can look at it this way, to give a very gross analogy. Let's imagine that spirituality could be compared to a gas tank. So a Jew, let's say, a Jewish soul has a 16-gallon capacity. Again, taking the kuzari. A non-Jewish soul has a 10-gallon capacity. But the non-Jewish soul could have 10 gallons of gas in the tank, and the Jewish soul could be on empty. So it turns out that there may be many, many, many non-Jews who have reached spiritually higher levels and are closer to God than many Jews. It's not an automatic ticket. However, I think the Kuzari at least would say that a Jewish soul does have a higher ultimate potential. But given the reality that none of us are ever functioning at our potential anyway, you really can't even make a comparison. I mean, you could not make an automatic comparison. Is a Jew better than a Goy, or is a Goy better than a Jew? Depends on the Jew, depends on the Goy. I think we could say, at least the Kuzari would say it, some people find this problematical as well, that if everybody would be operating at a full tank, the Jewish soul is considered to be more receptive to spirituality. But that's never the reality that you face. So I would see no reason to push chosenness. I would basically say, you know, let's say your child asks you, am I chosen? I say, it doesn't make a difference. You have to live the best life that you can. You have to be the best you that you can. And then, you know, you'll find out after 120 years whether you are or you're not. In other words, it's not necessarily something that is so essential to daily life. I remember in the book, in one of the Sherlock Holmes books, it emerged that Sherlock Holmes was not aware that the Earth rotates around the sun. You know, he was pre-Copernicus. So Dr. Watson was so amazed. He says, how can you not know that? He says, in my line of work, it really doesn't make a difference. It really doesn't make much of a difference. You know, so I would say that there are certain ideas that I think are inherently true, but if they are being prone to being misunderstood, they don't necessarily have to be emphasized.
Well, once again,
you can understand that psychologically. Listen, if you are part of a people that were oppressed, that were disparaged, that were denigrated, that were considered subhuman, you can understand that there is a need to build ourselves up as well. I mean, one can understand. One has to have some sympathy for what Jesus went through. Yeah.
The message of Isaiah that the possibility of the idea that should it be that the Jews are chosen to be more responsible than others for the holiness of the world, and all people should do that? Or should it be whoever looks at this text and sees himself in it should should feel more, should feel himself to be, whether he's a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, or whatever, should feel responsible to the extent that he can be for the holiness of the world. In other words, everybody sees himself as very
necessary. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, again, as you would
expect. Because everybody see that.
Right. As you would expect, the Khuzri does opt for the first explanation.
Yeah.
And he gives the famous mashal that the Jew is the heart of the world. This is what he's acting. He uses, you see, he uses human body imagery quite often. He uses the Mishkan is a body, as it were, for God's presence. The Jewish people are the heart of the human organism, and consequently the heart is responsible for the health of the entire organism. You're offering yet another aspect, which I think is a worthwhile perspective as well, and that is, look at myself as someone that is responsible. Certainly that's a helpful way of proceeding. But it is interesting, again, if you look at the history of Jewish interpretation, you will see that the vast majority of Jewish commentators did not want to interpret Isaiah 53 as referring to even the ultimate Mashiach, because that raised very theologically problematic issues, and by and large they interpreted it to refer to Klal Yisrael. Yeah. I think it's beautiful. I think that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's your choice. That's right. That's right. And in fact, that is Rashi quotes that when it says in the Shema that these words should be on your heart. The words that I command you today should be on your heart. So Rashi says, why today? Every single day, you are confronted with a new choice that you're making. It's not simply we were Jews, therefore we are Jews. We choose. In fact, idea here is, in fact, Yeshayahu talks about that a lot. It's called mitzvata nashim ilumada, not doing things out of habit, but to do things out of conscious choice. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, that is exactly the Kuzari. In the fourth chapter, which we haven't gotten to yet, in the fourth essay, Rav Yehuda HaLevi articulates in one of the most famous passages that he views both Christianity and Islam as transitional ways to bring the ancient pagans to follow the way of God. And he does see them in a historically useful and productive role, which is very interesting. Here is a man who is writing, you know, in the midst of many persecutions and the like, and yet he saw them as having a constructive role to bring people to God. By the way, this is also in Maimonides, but it's a censored passage in Maimonides. If you look at the very end of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, where he has the last two chapters of the work discuss Mashiach, so as you would expect, he has some references to Jesus there, which were just taken out. They were just excised in the Middle Ages. But you know, we know what they are. I mean, we found it in manuscripts. But among the excised passages was, in his disparagement of the Christian claim that Jesus is Messiah, he does indicate that God allowed these religions to spread because they were a way of weaning people away from paganism. So he did see this as a constructive development in a sense. And, but I think Rav Yehuda HaLevi was the first one. Yeah, I'm not entirely clear. I don't have any proof one way or the other if the Rambam saw the Kuzari. Certainly the Kuzari, Yehuda HaLevi, predated the Rambam. But there are various points in which, of course, on one hand, they're very, very different. On the other hand, there are certain thoughts that could have been borrowed from the Kuzari. By the way, it's interesting, I just saw it today for the first time. The Rambam has a quote, this is very fascinating to me, that the Rambam writes in his introduction to Pirkei Avot, which is called the Eight Chapters, that he's going to state a lot of philosophical ideas that he borrowed from other people. And he even says, and I'm going to reproduce whole paragraphs that I borrowed from other people, but I'm not going to tell you where, because that would be distracting. So, it's very, very interesting. The Rambam just told you ahead of time that he's going to do some plagiarism, but, you know, it's full disclosure. But, you know, as long as I'm telling you I'm plagiarizing, and that's going to be okay. Which is interesting, because it is true that there are passages in the Rambam that clearly were in the Chovat HaLevavot. And that book, I know, the Rambam was familiar with, because he writes that it was his father's favorite book. The Kuzari, I'm not sure. I have not seen any reference to Rambam and the Kuzari, although it would be interesting to see if he did have that. Yeah.
I'm wondering, with all of that tension along with the traditional faith now, and all
okay, absolutely. Okay, so here you have to understand this. If you look in the prophets, or look in Isaiah, Yeshayahu chapter 2, you clearly talk about the fact that all will go to the temple and serve God. In fact, you know the song that people sing, Ki Mitzion, Tei Torah, that the Torah will come out of Zion. If you look at Yeshayahu, that is what the non-Jews are going to be saying. That's really a non-Jewish refrain in the days of the Mashiach. Now, that does not mean they will become Jews. That does not mean they're going to, you know, wear talit and tefillin. It means they will believe in God, and that would be the seven commandments of Noah and the like. We don't proselytize. And in fact, there's even a rabbinic statement that says, once Mashiach comes, we're not going to accept converts, because we can no longer gauge sincerity. You know, but Mashiach's coming, you know, you want to jump on the bandwagon. Sincerity is when you want to become a Jew when things aren't so great for the Jewish people. But again, even the messianic goal is not that everybody should be Jewish. And again, Judaism is unique, really, as a religion, because it has never preached that adherence to Judaism by the world is the only way to achieve salvation. We are not at all exclusivist in that claim. That's a very unique feature of Judaism, certainly over Christianity and over Islam. However, there is a concept that the whole world will have true faith in the true God, and then we'll serve God in accordance with the basic tenets of morality as embodied in the Noahide code.
But the Jews will still be
Jews, yeah. Jews will continue to have the Torah, etc. and that's the tradition that the Torah will not be abrogated. That's one of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, that even when the Mashiach comes, the Torah will consider to be binding. Yeah.
In a way, it's a kind of a turning on its head, the notion that chosenness of Jews is
that's right.
So if we were to turn it the other way and say, no, anybody can join our club, we would also be saying that then the end of days all have to join our club. Which is more or less the position of Christianity, that ultimately all have to do it our way.
That's right. But our
point is that the very notion of chosenness means that not everybody has to join. They don't get to join.
Right.
Maybe. But in any case, they don't have to.
Right. Well, which goes back to the earlier point. You got to choose to be chosen. That's right. It's not something you're ever going to be forced into. At least for a non-Jew. But I just want to leave you one final thought about the murder and Avodah Zarah and Shvichas Dam. We talked about kind of collective responsibility. We talked about the various aspects of anger and embarrassment, which are subcategories of these sins. But there's another thought too, which is related, and that is the three cardinal sins for which a Jew must give his life, right? Those three cardinal sins, idolatry, murder, and sexual offenses, are really not just sins, but they are symptoms of characterological flaws. They are simply the most extreme outward manifestation of sicknesses of the soul. And the sicknesses of the soul that they're correlated to are what Pirkei Avot says. There's a famous passage in Pirkei Avot that says there are three forces that drive a person away from the world. And that is kinah. Kinah is jealousy and envy. Tava, that's unrestrained lust and desire for sensual gratification. And the third is kavod, a desire for ego gratification and honor. These are three forces that drive a person out of the world. What world are we referring to? We're not just referring to the world to come. That's obvious, you know, you can destroy your world to come. But we're even referring to this world. Because it's obvious that if one lives a life of jealousy, envy, ego, you know, ego, need to have their ego stroked all the time, their life is going to be pretty miserable. Because every single time, there's always something good in their life, they're always going to say, well, I wanted more. I wanted something else. Right? This is the part of the problem we have with children today. It might be something very nice, but they wanted more, because we've all become habituated in a negative sense to always wanting and being envious of others. Now, Rav Tzadok, one of the great Hasidic masters, draws the following correlation. Jealousy is often correlated to anger. Right? Jealousy can give rise to rage. And that, in turn, in its extreme sense, could manifest itself in murder. In fact, statistically, that's the case. If you look at, just as we know, the Columbine Massacre was an example of that, but if you look at most murders, the most homicides that are committed are not by strangers, somebody just, you know, wants to rap, they're by people that have had some relationship, O.J. Simpson or whatever it is. Rage, anger, jealousy, taken to an extreme, shvichas damim. Tava, unrestrained sensual lust, obviously correlates to giloy arayot, sexual offenses. Now, the third one is a bit more subtle. Idolatry correlates to kavod. Why is that so? Because kavod is when serving my ego, my glory, becomes more important than submission to God. Therefore, kavod is self-worship, worship of the self. Worship of the self is indeed an idol. One makes oneself an idol with clay feet, to use the imagery of the book of Daniel. But once again, self-idolization is perhaps the most pervasive form of idolatry. So consequently, going back to the Asara B'Tevet idea, which is a long digression, but I think it's worthwhile, because it does correlate with some points the Kuzari makes, that is, when we think about the sin of Avodah Zarah, Giloy Arayot, Shvichas Damim, we're not only thinking about those particular sins, but we're thinking about the underlying character flaws, which in their extremity can result in this. The jealousy which can culminate in murder. the lust that can culminate in arayot, and the ego gratification that could culminate in self-idolization and in making yourself more glorious, as it were, than the need of God. In fact, it's interesting, if you think about this, you know, we always praise humility as a wonderful quality. Moses is the most humble person who ever lived in the world. And what does humility mean, right? So, well, humility says, I don't consider myself better than anyone else. I consider myself, you know, worse than other people. Now, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's feeling every morning he got up? Did he say, oh, I'm so stupid, I just, you know, everyone in the Jewish people knows the Torah better than I. You know, if humility would mean a person did not recognize their talents and their ability and their value, not only would it not be a positive attribute, it would be a negative attribute. In fact, it would be delusional. It would be psychotic. If Moshe, I mean, how could you praise as a moral virtue something that is just unrealistic? It's just not true. So there are a lot of explanations. You know, humility means you recognize your worth, but you know it's a gift from God. You know that it has responsibilities, right? But I saw from Rabbi Kiveger a very interesting thought. He says, the humble person does not think wonderfully of himself, and he does not think negatively of himself. He just doesn't think about life in those terms. Meaning to say, true humility is a person who approaches life with a task orientation rather than a personality orientation. Meaning to say, there is a common denominator between the humble person, not the humble, but between the person with low self-esteem and the arrogant person. Because the arrogant person looks at everything as a referendum validating his worth, and the one with low self-esteem looks at everything that happens as a validator of his worthlessness. True humility means you look at the world, you look at what needs to be done in the world, you look at with honesty how you're able to contribute to that, and you joyously participate to the best of your ability in trying to get those things done. And you rejoice when other people get it done as well, because it's not a question of you versus them. It's a question of looking at life as a cooperative enterprise in which we all work together. So the point is, you know, in an ideal sense, I mean, this is an ideal sense, most of us cannot get to that level, but in an ideal sense, you know, me, you, him, that doesn't make a difference. The issue is the work at them. Actually, Ronald Reagan said it very well. Ronald Reagan said, there is no end to what you can accomplish when you don't care who gets the credit. And that statement from Ronald Reagan, it's not a Gemara, but it's a good statement. And that is really what true humility is. It's simply not putting yourself as the center of attention. And ironically, those with chronic low self-esteem are playing that same center of attention game, because everything is about them. When in fact, the truth of the matter is, what do they say? I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker, a very cute cartoon. A psychiatrist is treating a patient on the couch, and the psychiatrist says, I got good news for you. You don't have an inferiority complex, you're just inferior. So you're right. So the point is, you know, to look at the world as this, as if everybody is thinking about you, positively or negatively, when in fact nobody's thinking about you. Because if nobody's thinking about you at all, you know, it's a more realistic way of behaving. So the idea of kavod is the incessant need to get people's approval. And that's a very, very destructive thing. Because when you live your life to get people's approval, unfortunately, you'll always feel a little starved. You'll never be satisfied, you know, because somebody compliments you on one thing, so you think to yourself, what about the other thing? You know, why didn't they say anything about that, right? So the point is, there's a certain treadmill here, and getting off the kavod treadmill is a very empowering and very, very liberating type of feeling. And so this is what you think about during this fast of Asara B'Tevet. Yeah.
So it relates to why the great charity then is anonymous.
That's correct. You get the job done. It doesn't have to be... In fact, the Chazon Ish gives a very interesting example of hospitality as a good example. You know, as you know, in Jewish communities, it's a special mitzvah to offer people hospitality any day of the week, but particularly on the Shabbat or the like. If you see someone that's new in the synagogue who may not know where to go, So it's very customary that, you know, you go over to a total stranger and say, would you like to have dinner with us? Or whatever. Some synagogues are more institutionalized. They have hospitality coordinators that you go to and the like. So the Chazon Ish gives the following mashal. He talks about the fact that even when we do loving kindness, it's often as a means of getting approval. He says, imagine that you always like to have guests for Shabbat. And the service is over and you see a lonely person in the back of the synagogue. And you're so happy because you'll be able to invite them. And you go and you offer them hospitality. And their response to you is, well, thank you, but so-and-so just invited me. So the Chazon Ish says, do you feel bad about that, or do you feel good about that? So he says, it really depends on what the operating motivation is. If the motivation is a true desire to help another person, then in a sense, you should be indifferent to whether it's you or somebody else. And I'm so happy that, you know, that someone is going to take care of you. If the issue is, you know, I want to get the credit, then you're going to feel bad, gee, you know, why am I losing that opportunity? So the Chazon Ish points out that even our altruism has a sometimes a selfish tinge to it, and it comes out of the desire of kavod.
Do you desire even for yourself? Never say that it feels bad because someone else is doing it, but you still have the desire to do it yourself.
It's a little complicated. It's not entirely clear. Meaning to say that if the sum total of mitzvot is the same, then it's not entirely clear that a person should feel bad that he didn't do it. Well, that's simply because that's an expression of your... Yeah, mitzvah law means, normally, if you have a commandment and you can get someone else to do it for you, let's say preparing for Shabbat, I could hire somebody or I could do things myself, it's better for me to do it myself. But that's because when you have to do something, and the question is, should you delegate it, it's a lack of respect that shows that you don't care about it so much if you get someone else to do it. But if it already got done without you, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should feel upset about that. Okay, one other thought about the Beit HaMikdash, and then we'll continue with the Kuzari. Yeah, so we discussed the, he has borne our sicknesses, the Isaiah, the suffering servants. Yeah, the Gemara tells us in Tractate Pesachim that the Beit HaMikdash was referred to by our patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, obliquely, by allusion, and each of them employed a different noun in describing the Beit HaMikdash. Avraham Avinu referred to the Beit HaMikdash as a mountain. If you remember, according to tradition, the site where Avraham was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak, Mount Moriah, is the site of the Beit HaMikdash, that is the Temple Mount. And Avraham called it a har, a mountain, a mountain. Yitzchak, it says, when Yitzchak met Rivka, so the Pasuk says, Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach basadeh, Yitzchak went to contemplate in the field. Again, according to tradition, that was also Mount Moriah, but it was no longer described as a mountain, it was described as a field, sadeh. Yaakov had his dream of the ladder that went up to heaven, and he said, this is the Beit Elohim, this is the house of God. Once again, rabbinic tradition is, he had a vision of the temple, and he called it a bayit. So Chazal point out that we have three different nouns for the temple. Mountain, field, and home. And what's the concept here? So once again, it would seem that if we view the Beit HaMikdash as a repository for the divine presence, and if we view our homes as the ultimate Beit HaMikdash, as Nachmanides teaches us, and our synagogues as miniature Beit HaMikdash, it would be teaching us that a Jewish home and a Jewish synagogue, both of which have temple aspects, have to embody three characteristics. The characteristic of the mountain, the characteristic of the field, and the characteristic of the home. How is that so? So let's look at a mountain. As you know, in the ancient world in particular, although it doesn't help much with aerial bombing, but in the ancient world in particular, a mountain was a very secure place to be when the enemy tries to attack you. Right? And that's part of why Jerusalem was strategically important in the ancient world, because it was on hills, and therefore you try to run up, etc., so the enemy could pour boiling oil down at you, and arrows, and rocks, and all sorts of things. So a mountain could be perceived metaphorically as a refuge and escape. from the hordes of things that are out there that can try to destroy you physically or spiritually or morally. And therefore, the first idea is that the Beit HaMikdash, the soul, the Jewish home, is a place to get away from that which is degrading, and that which is destructive, and that which is corrosive. Kind of a way of rejecting and keeping out impurity, filth, everything else. Now, of course, in this day of mass media, in this day of television, in this day of internet, that gets more and more difficult to try to achieve. But there is a concept, again, this is a difficult concept, particularly, you know, if, in a way, if one adopts a life of total ghettoization, although even then, you really cannot keep everything out, in a way, one has an easier time of it, I just keep everything out. But for people who are committed, as I guess most of us are, to the notion of modernity, of living in the world, of recognizing that there are positive aspects to culture and the world, the issue of creating limited barriers in one way or the other is a very, very difficult issue. But it's a difficult issue, but that doesn't mean that it's not a valid issue. And that is, if one lives a life of holiness, if one lives a life of commitment, there are certain things that need to be excluded. There are certain rules that have to be made. There are certain standards that have to be lived up to. And of course, where people will draw the line will depend on each person. But nevertheless, the concept that there needs to be boundaries and there needs to be limits is something that's very, very fundamental. And that's the metaphor of the mountain. The mountain means certain things we don't let in. Whatever those certain things are, that's a talk for another time. That's dimension number one of sanctity. Excluding certain things. Certain things you have to say no about. Right? You can't just say everything goes. But we then come to a second stage. And that is a field. A Judaism that is based on negation and on rejection and what we're against is ultimately not a Judaism that sustains the spirit. You can't define what you are exclusively by what you're not. You can't say, I am Jewish because I don't believe in Jesus. That's frankly not enough. Because unless there's a positive content to what it means to be a Jew, unless it's a source of growth, unless it's a source of spirituality, unless it's a source of holiness, unless it's a source of a joy and appreciation for life, all you're doing is negating, and at some point the question is going to be, what's wrong with what you're negating if you're not offering an alternative vision? That is the metaphor of a field. Because what is a field? A field is a place of productivity, a place of growth, a place where new life can be created, right? The new growth that comes. But that is commensurate with the effort that you put in, right? It doesn't come for free. If you don't cultivate the field, you get weeds. But if you cultivate, if you plant, if you take care, if you nurture, there's a place of spiritual growth. So if the mountain is the notion of rejecting that which is noxious, the field is the positive affirmation of what one is living for. And the third dimension of bayit, home, that connotes the notion of community, camaraderie, friendship, and love. Meaning the concept is that Judaism is not a soul journey. It's not a journey in isolation. But it's a journey that does require the bonds of friendship and love and family. The concept of not doing it alone, but creating either a natural family or an extended family, or a whatever family unit there is, extended friends, whatever, a community that comes together and accomplish it. Right? So these three dimensions are connected to the three ways that we make sanctuaries of our own lives, knowing to negate, knowing to construct positive affirmation, and at the same time doing so in the context of a community. Right? So these are some of the lessons of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. Yeah. The end of the essay of the Kuzri, the end of chapter 2 of the Kuzri, he has a very, very long, relatively long, not very long, but around 10 pages or so, devoted to the beauties of the Hebrew language. If you found this hard to understand, I also found it very hard to understand. There are a lot of reasons why it's hard to understand. Number one, it is absolutely clear that this was written from the ear of one of the greatest poets that we've had in the Hebrew language, because the various sensitivities and nuances that he has to language, frankly, may escape us. Meaning to say that in terms of where syllables break and the like, unless one has the ear of Rav Yehuda HaLevi, one doesn't really understand what all the things he's talking about are. It reminded me when I was reading this of the fact that it is said that Eskimos have 300 terms for different shades of whites. They are so sensitized to the significance of different types of snow that they see nuances and shadings in things that would totally escape us. You know, we would look at snow and snow, we wouldn't even see the difference, and they see all sorts of subtle differences. I had the impression that his particular attention to nuances of language was a function of his extreme sensitivity to language, which would make it difficult for us to even follow exactly what he's referring to. Another reason is that the classification of diktuk, Hebrew grammar, that we are familiar with today is actually a fairly modern invention. And the terminology and the structure as it existed in the Middle Ages was not at all the same. And in fact, it's very interesting that the way we teach diktuk, we have it backwards in some ways. I'm not an expert in this either, so I don't want to step too much in areas of my relative ignorance. But, you know, in Hebrew, one of the most dominant characteristics of diktuk is the binyanim. Binyanim are the various verb forms. So we have pa'al, and we have nifal, etc. And these are different verb forms. Now, most of us, the way most of us approach this analytically is we assume that these verb forms have different meanings, and to express different meanings, we have grammatically a different word. So, for example, ani shomer, right, which is the present, let's say, of the plow. I am watching something. Ani nishmar, I am being watched. Right, so we would call the first the plow, or it used to be called cow when I was growing up, and the now and the passive is called. They don't call cow anymore, I know. But then nishmar is the nifal. So we have the sense that first there is the meaning and then there's the binyan. That's not really true. The truth of the matter is the binyanim are used even in Tanakh in not a fully consistent sense. You know, you'll have nifal sometimes here and there. Meaning the binyanim preceded the concept of them having fixed meanings. The concept that the meaning and the binyan are inextricably linked is not necessarily true in biblical or Mishnaic Hebrew. In other words, the binyanim had an existence independent of the particularized meanings of the structure, which is a very confusing idea, meaning Hebrew had different verb forms before there were distinct meanings attached to those verb forms. That is even true for tenses like past, present, and future, in which something we identify as an atid did not always mean a future in the Bible, meaning the structures predated the assigned meanings, which is a very almost bizarre notion in language in terms of the way we would understand it, but nevertheless that's the case. But I just want to give you one example. The Kuzri talks about the fact that Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, was the original language of the world. This was traditional Jewish teaching. In fact, it is said in those days when they would do barbaric human experiments, King James, famous King James, who commissioned the translation of the Bible, the elegant King James Version, wanted to show, he was told by somebody, although I don't believe that, that this is a midrash at all, that if a child would be exposed to no language at all, he would naturally speak Hebrew, because Hebrew is the holy tongue. So in those days, what did he do? He just took some kids, you know, put them in a room, did not allow them to hear any language, to see what they would come up with. And, you know, of course, they didn't really come up with that much. But nevertheless, there is the concept that Hebrew was the original Lashon HaKodesh, the language in which God created the world, and it has a certain sanctity. And in fact, it's very interesting. You know, in the Chumash, we occasionally have words that are not Hebrew words. Rashi says, for example, in this famous verse in the Kriya Shema, it says, "Ukishartam liot al yadecha," you should tie the phylacteries, the tefillin, as a sign onto your hands. And then it says, "V'hayu l'totafot," they should be frontlets, "bein einecha," between your eyes. So Rashi says, what does the word totafot mean? Totafot does not appear. It's not a Hebrew word. So Rashi says it's an acronym. Tat, the tot, the two tetas, are the number two in Coptic. And pat is another language, in a certain African language too. So it's 2-2, indicating that the head tefillin are divided into four compartments that have four parchments. So the question is, why is the Torah using Coptic and an African language? Why doesn't it use a Hebrew language? Because how do you explain a totally foreign, non-Hebrew word in that? So the way the commentaries explain it is the following. That Hebrew, the Hebrew language, was originally a more inclusive language than it is now. And what happened is, at the Tower of Babel, when everyone was speaking Hebrew, and then God made everybody have these different languages, but God gave each language some Hebrew words that became part of their language. In other words, certain words were taken out of Hebrew and were given there. Therefore, when Rashi says, this is Coptic, or this is African, Rashi means to say, this was indigenously Hebrew prior to the Tower of Babel, but this was one of the lost Hebrew words, as it were, that left the Hebrew language at the time of the Tower of Babel. So Rashi makes the point, therefore, that there is lost Hebrew, just like the lost 10 tribes, there are actually lost Hebrew words as a result of the Tower of Babel. But just to give you one example, though, that in Hebrew, it is said that the significance of a word is not only in the meaning of the word, but even the letters that are used to form the word. Let me just tell you one example of this. Let's take the word for love. The shoresh, the root of love, if it's a three-letter shoresh, is aleph, hey, bet, ahav. Actually, by the way, the notion that shirashim have to be three letters is also a fairly modern notion. Many have argued that original Hebrew roots would be two letters. And this would actually explain, etymologically, if you compare many, many verbs that share two common letters, although a grammarian might say these are not the same root because they have a different first letter, but in fact, etymologically and conceptually, there might be a connection because they may go back to an earlier root which only had two letters. But if you go to the three roots of aleph, hey, bet, it's very interesting. Let's look at the three letters. Aleph represents one, the singular, the individual. Hey, if you sound it out, hey is a letter, but it's also a word. It's hey aleph. There's a word in the shortest word in the Torah. Well, there are a number of two-letter words, but one of the shortest words is the word, I know it's in my son's bar mitzvah parsha, so I know this. It says in this week's Torah reading, hey lachem zera, when Yosef is telling people, take seed, hey lachem, take. Bet is the other, the second. So what does ahav mean? The singular reaches out and gives to the other. The aleph extends himself or herself to the bet, to the second one. And hey is that letter of hey, giving oneself to the other. Right? So you see that the very use of these letters has a certain significance. But again, as I say, the particular grammatical structure is very difficult. Although there's one amazing, I don't know if you noticed this, the Kuzri offers this amazing, I would say it's just a wild guess on his part, but he offers this amazing speculation. He's asked at one point by the king, why do Jews move when they pray? Why do they shuckle? Right? Did you see what he said? So he offers the reason that in the olden days, when people only had a small number of books, so let's say you had 20 people who have to look in the same book, so I would look forward, then I would move back, so you could move forward. So he says, that is why Jews move back and forth, because it was a way of sharing the book when they couldn't be together. You know, I mean, that I think is really, was just a guess on his part. I mean, the standard explanation that is given is that there is a concept that says in Psalms, "Kol asmotai tamarna mi kamocha," person, all of his limbs should be moved. Just like we have the Quakers and Shakers, right? There's a sect of Quakers called Shakers, they have trouble. You know, they don't. They're celibate also, so they're dying out. They only accept converts. There aren't too many people who want to convert to Shakerdom. But they also believe in the concept of when one is moved by the Spirit of God, one physically moves. But this is one of the more interesting speculations of Yehuda Levi, that it came from the shortage of Svarim that existed. Now, one thing I do know that's very similar. You know, many Yemenite Jews can read Hebrew backwards, meaning they can read from the inside. And this is indeed said, because in Yemen, children would sit on all sides of a book. So many did develop the capacity of reading backwards and the like. That I know is the case. But the Kudzari's point is reminiscent of a joke they tell about a certain Hasidic synagogue that was very faithful to tradition. So when they would dance around the Bima and Simchat Torah, whenever they reached a certain part in the service, they would bow down and straighten up. And nobody figured out why that was so. And they said, well, this was the old custom. The Rebbe did it, and the Rebbe's father did it, and the Rebbe's grandfather does it. So this is a sacred custom. So one time the Rebbe, who had retired to Israel, comes, and they're asking him, you know, why do you do this? He says, well, in the original building, there was the slow chandelier. You know, whenever we, you know, we had to do it. So it became a custom that they adopted. Okay. All right, but that's, again, I myself want to go back and reread the Hebrew language section. As I say, that there's a lot there that I think only the very... I mean, the truth of the matter is, we have lost a lot of Hebrew in many ways. It's very clear, for example, at least for the non-Yemenite traditions, that a dalet is supposed to come in two forms, a dalet with a dagesh and a dalet without a dagesh. In Ashkenazic and even Israeli Sephardic pronunciation, they're indistinguishable. The gimel with the dagesh, right? So the truth is there are all sorts of nuances of pronunciation, a kamatz katan, a kamatz gadol, whether you do it like Ashkenaz or Sephard, you either make them both like a patach or both like a kamatz, right? So obviously there is a whole lost, or relatively lost for the vast majority of Hebrew speakers, a whole lost system. And I'm just amazed at, you know, how little we seem to be pronouncing Hebrew the way it was intended to be pronounced by, and that doesn't make a difference if it's with Ashkenazit or Tzfardit, and none of that makes a difference, because all of that is very attenuated, and it's not really the way Hebrew is pronounced. Yeah?
I've heard about a book, I ordered it actually, I haven't seen it yet, it's called The Odes and Odds of Torah Reading.
Uh-huh.
I cannot recall the author's name right now, it's a woman, but I don't remember her name. It talks about, in particular, Hamas Katan, and
uh-huh.
which is related to it, and also gives lists in Tanakh of which ones are which. I haven't seen it, though.
Uh-huh. Right, but the question becomes, you know, you can look in all sorts of books of Diktuk, which are Kamatzkata, which are Kamatzkata, but nobody shows you how to pronounce it. Good, I mean, I can tell you this is that, this and that, but everyone pronounces it the same. So we really have a very, very attenuated sense of how Hebrew is supposed to be pronounced, which is very disheartening. I'm very disheartened to learn that all my years I don't pronounce Hebrew correctly. Yeah.
This whole idea of
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So maybe we're getting some of them back to me.
You know, I think that as a holy language and
yeah.
as a way of communicating with God, that that would be a very good thing.
Yes.
And that would be
Right.
And,
well, you know, again, there's always the issue. The issue always becomes how do you deal with parallelism? Well, that's always the question, right? You can always show there are features in culture A that are similar to features in culture B, right? You can show similarities of language. You can show similarities of stories. Right? Most ancient cultures have what is called a flood myth, or the like. You can show Roman law from a much later period. Roman law is very similar to Talmudic law, right? You can show. Right? You can always show comparisons. The question is, what does a comparison demonstrate? Does a comparison necessarily show that one borrowed from the other? And if it shows one borrowed from the other, in which direction did it go? Right? People are too facile to jump to a conclusion that similarity indicates borrowing, and often they misattribute which direction the borrowing goes. Even kashrut, you can find in the ancient world various food taboos that existed, right? Certain menstruation, certainly, rules against menstruation, separate tents. I mean, this was common in many African cultures as well. The question becomes, however, similarity does not indicate borrowing, and it does not indicate a lack of originality, and it could very well be that if God's Torah was heard by everybody, it permeated and got translated in different ways. But in terms of borrowing, let me just remind you, I think I mentioned it once before, I just want to mention it quickly. The Sefer Ikarim, in a passage that I don't think was reproduced for you, has a very lengthy discussion about the origin of the Hebrew alphabet. And this is based on a very troubling passage in Tractate Sanhedrin. The Hebrew alphabet as a Sefer Torah is written, the standard print Hebrew alphabet, that we call it print Hebrew alphabet, is called Kitav Ashurit, which literally means Assyrian writing. Now, if you've ever seen in a dictionary or other pictures what is called Old Hebrew, which resembles more of a hieroglyphic type of writing, that's called Kitav Ivri, that is called Hebrew script. In other words, the Hebrew alphabet as we have it is called Kitav Ashurit, and the other one is called Kitav Ivri. Now, Kitav Ashurit, the Talmud gives us a number of explanations why it's called Kitav Ashurit, but one of the explanations is that Ezra, at the time of the Second Temple, borrowed or took over this writing from Assyria, or Babylonia, that's not clear why Assyria would be around, and indicated that that would be the holy script. Now, that's an amazing thing, because that would seem to indicate, if you take it literally, that the Ten Commandments and the Torah that Moshe got was in that old Hebrew script. And how would it be possible? Remember the story of Rabbi Akiva? Moshe saw Rabbi Akiva, who was looking at the various crowns. Certain letters of Kitav Ashurit have lines, and he was interpreting them as being significant. How could that be significant if that was simply the Assyrian alphabet, and that wasn't the language in which God gave the Torah? So Rabbi Albo actually takes the position that he interprets the Gemara very literally, and he actually says that there was a change in the Hebrew script, and indeed the Jewish alphabet is not the original alphabet by which God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. This is his position. He takes the Gemara very, very literally, but he's very, very sharply criticized, and there are many alternative explanations that are given. Now, yeah. Yes.
They don't want to use the holy language,
but maybe
they
switched over
to the Syrian alphabet in order not to
write
the holy alphabet, unless they were doing.
Okay. Actually, the alternative explanation actually goes in the opposite direction, but that's interesting. Okay. But Rav Albo does take the position there was a change. So you're suggesting that may have been the reason for the change, because to keep the Kitav Ivri as a holy language apart. But again, that would still contradict the idea, though, that in the Kitav Ashurit there's all sorts of secrets and messages in terms of that. Yeah.
Can we know that it's relatively different from the Arabic and the Semitic were very similar, and even within modern times, Arabic, Hebrew, or French Hebrew?
No, there's no question that Hebrew over the years, sure. In fact, by the way, the famous thing that we call Rashi script, it was not, had nothing to do with Rashi. The only reason it's called Rashi script is that when they printed Rashi, they used that particular script. I mean, Rashi script just is a reference to a particular type of script. And there's no obligation that Rashi has to be printed in Rashi script. You can print Rashi in regular script too. No, I understand that. The question that there were different Hebrew scripts is fine, but the question in particular focuses on the Kitav Ashurit of the Sefer Torah, that it's theologically difficult to say that that script, which is always in our tradition has a special holiness and a special significance. That specifically would not have been the language in which, or the alphabet in which God gave the Torah. By the way, there's another question on the Sefer Ikarim. Listen, this is very fascinating. The Talmud tells us that when God gave the Ten Commandments to Moshe, the writing of the Ten Commandments pierced the tablets. The letters went all the way through. And the Gemara says, well, there's a problem with a final mem and a final samach. Because if you think about it, a final mem and a final samach, it'll be the whole of a donut there, right? So if the samach goes all the way through, how come the middle didn't fall out? And the Gemara answers that the middle of the donuts, of the mem and the samach, must have been their benes. It was a miracle. It was just suspended there. So the question is that if you look at the old Hebrew equivalents, you don't have that particular problem. If the Gemara posits there's a problem, the Gemara is assuming Ketav Ashurit. So just to show you that, just very quickly, the alternative explanation to that Gemara, that it's borrowed from Assyria, just means the following. It's really a totally different meaning. It basically means that Ketav Ashurit was always the language of the Sefer Torah and the Luchot, but people were not using it in everyday Sefer Torah. In other words, that was reserved for the holiest of holy, the opposite of your point. And what Ezra did was, Ezra then felt that it was legitimate and appropriate to utilize that Ketav for other reasons as well. So it wasn't borrowed from Assyria, it simply means its widespread use dates from the Assyrian-Babylonian exile. But again, this was a controversial issue regarding the status of the Aleph Beis, which to some degree, at least like the Sefer Ikarim, I suppose, if we're willing to borrow the Assyrian alphabet, maybe it's not so bad to borrow Hebrew words from other languages. But I'll tell you the opposite. I'll tell you a point, though, that I know people who would rather use a foreign word than an indigenous Hebrew word. For example, electricity. Electricity is commonly referred to as chashmal. Now, chashmal is a biblical term. It comes from chapter 1 of Yechezkel, which is the mystical vision of God's divine chariot. And chashmal refers to the radiance and glory that surrounds the divine throne. There are those who in all seriousness feel that that's not the appropriate term to use for a light bulb. This is a term that connotes divinity and radiance, and therefore they will write electric. You know, they'll use an anglicized word for that because they feel it's a desecration of Lashon HaKodesh to apply it to those things. So that's a whole machlokas. What was it? Well, you know, as you know, the father of modern Hebrew is Eliezer ben Yehuda, whose house is still on the borders of Mea Shearim. It's very, very interesting. And he was a fanatic in this matter. It's fascinating because when he came to Israel, nobody was speaking Hebrew as a language at all. And he insisted that in his home that only Hebrew be spoken. And as a result, his children had no friends at all, because there were none of his children's friends spoke Hebrew. And he would not let his children associate with kids who did not speak Hebrew. But there weren't any kids who spoke Hebrew. So the story goes, his child did not talk till 4 years old. It's funny, it's the opposite of, it didn't really work. And once he came home, what made his son wrote it, I think his son wrote an autobiography. What happened, he came home and he overheard his wife singing a Russian lullaby to their son. So he was so mad, he broke a table. Because he thought if you get the child used to another language, he'll never be willing to focus on Hebrew. And his son finally started saying, "Don't do that!" You know, he said something in Russian. So his first words were telling his father not to break the table. But be it as it may. All right. All right. But anyway, we'll talk more about this next week. Maybe we'll stop here. Oh wow, okay, everything gets spread out. Okay, so next time we're going to focus on the third chapter of the Kuzari. Next time, we have a long break? Okay.